Good afternoon and welcome to HealthCetera. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. Today on HealthCetera, we're going to hear from nurses who are writers, writing about their experiences in working with people and their families during some of the most challenging times of their lives, and doing so within a healthcare system that is chaotic and often fails to recognize the importance of nurses to the health, well-being, comfort, and survival of those in their care. We'll open with an interview I conducted some weeks ago with nurse author Teresa Brown, whose latest book, The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives, was recently selected as one of the best books of the year by the New York Times. We'll then close with a series of readings that were held at a reading of nurses' stories and poetry in October of 2015 at the Organic Soul Food Cafe at the 6th Street Community Center on Manhattan's Lower East Side. First up, my interview with acclaimed nurse author Teresa Brown.
Nursing has long suffered from public misconceptions of what nurses do. In September, Michelle Collins and Joy Behar, two of the women who host the daytime television program The View, outraged nurses across the country and across the world with dismissive and demeaning comments about a nurse in the Miss America pageant who decided to forgo showcasing her skills as a pianist during the talent section of the program and instead came out in scrubs with a stethoscope around her neck and told a story about the impact that she had on a patient's life and the patient's impact on hers. Using the hashtag ShowMeYourStethoscope, nurses around the world began posting to Facebook and Twitter photos of themselves in their uniforms and with a stethoscope around their neck and described the work they did that day and every day. Perhaps someone should give the hosts of The View a new book titled The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives, by Nurse Teresa Brown and published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Teresa Brown was a professor of English at Tufts University when she decided that she wanted to do more meaningful work and went to nursing school. She began writing about her work as a nurse in Western Pennsylvania, and it came to the attention of the New York Times, where she became a contributor to the paper's Well blog and now to its Opinionator column. Her first book, Critical Care, described her first year as a nurse on a hospital oncology unit. She now works part-time in hospice and palliative care. Teresa Brown, welcome back to HealthCetera, or HealthStyles, as the program was known when I interviewed you about your first book, Critical Care. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Diane. It's really a pleasure.
Now, just in the interest of transparency, Teresa Brown is a member of the National Advisory Council for the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College that is a sponsor of HealthCetera. And we're grateful for your support, Teresa. Thank you very much. You're a great advisor.
Oh, well, it's a great thing. So my pleasure again.
So let me begin by asking you whether indeed your publisher or you sent a copy of your book to Joy Behar and Michelle Collins and Whoopi Goldberg.
Well, my publicist very energetically tried to engage them and was not successful. But, you know, I never stopped to say, did we just send them a book? And as soon as the interview is over, I will find out.
Yeah, I think maybe they might take the time to read it after all that's happened. For those of you who are listeners, because of the outrage of nurses, the show lost almost all of their sponsors, including their major sponsors. And so they actually gave two apologies on the air that I thought were not very good, but that's another story.
And I agree with you. Yeah.
So, but the whole episode, I think, it showcases that the public, and even Joy Behar, who said that she's had care from nurses, but the public seldom understands what nursing is about until they are patients, and even then, I think they don't realize the critical thinking the nurse is doing while they're providing what the patient may think is basic care or highly technical care. Would you agree with that?
I would completely agree with that, and that was one of the main motivations for me to write The Shift, is I wanted people to understand how important nurses are to them getting good care in the hospital, because, like it or not, at some point in our lives, most of us will probably end up in the hospital, either as patients or as caregivers for people we love who are sick. And the general public needs to know that hospitals only run well if nurses are able to do our jobs well. And I thought that showing one shift would really give readers the texture of that in such a detailed way that it would really stick with them.
And it does. You're a very good storyteller, obviously a very good writer. I'm actually also interested in how much of the writing of this book and your other book comes from that interest in trying to educate people about what nurses do versus sort of this innate sense that you've got to write. I think you're one of these people who you've got to write.
Yeah, that's actually a great question, because when I became a nurse, I never had these visions of doing writing about nursing, and I thought, of course, I'll still love books, but the literature, study, writing part of my life is over, and that was fine. I had no regrets about that. And then I serendipitously fell into a writing career, unfortunately, as the result of a really bad experience as a new nurse that I decided to write down and liked what I wrote, and then said, well, aim high, I'll send it to the New York Times, and that got everything started. So
what was that bad experience? Tell our listeners about that bad experience.
Oh, sure. I had a patient who was set to go home who was ebullient and cheerful and very, very nice, lovely woman who started coughing up blood, and essentially in a minute or 2 minutes was dead. Mm. And we ran the code and tried for a while to resuscitate her, but it was just completely impossible. And someone told me later she was a lung cancer patient, and probably part of a tumor had broken off and burst her aorta, and you don't survive that. Mm-hmm. But it was the first time I really, really knew that things can change very, very quickly in the hospital, and as the nurse, you're the front line of that change. So it was a terrible experience, a transformative experience. Mm-hmm. It taught me a lot about what you can't expect or control. And so that's what I decided to put into writing. I felt for a long, long time, even after I started writing, well, I'm still primarily a nurse. I'm a nurse who writes, I would say, like there's all these physician writers. I'm a nurse writer. And now it's probably about 50-50. That I love the writing and I love the nursing, and they're just very mutually reinforcing.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's very interesting, Teresa, because as you know, I was the editor of the American Journal of Nursing for 10 years, and we had a reflections page for short stories that were nonfiction. And the vast majority of submissions for that column were nurses' experiences with a patient dying. And I think I'll bet almost every nurse can remember the first time a patient died of theirs that they were responsible for. I certainly remember it. And so it is about these profound and intimate moments that nurses are present for and are witnesses to. And your book, The Shift, I think, brings that alive. I mean, you you tell your own experiences, you describe it very vividly, as well as the experiences of the four patients that you're assigned that are assigned to you during this 1 hour shift. So how typical was this one shift of what you experienced every day and what other nurses experience every day?
This shift was atypical only in the two primary patients that I had, which really became the basis for writing this book. So there's a patient, Sheila, who has an unusual blood disorder, who I think is basically fine, and I'll probably learn some things, and it turns out she has a very serious surgical problem. Then I have my patient, Mr. Hampton, who's frail and elderly and is getting a drug called Rituxan, which can be very toxic during its infusion. So I'm quite worried about him, and things turn out there also differently than I expected. So that actual shift was another one of these transformative moments for me as a nurse when I realized that even with all our scans and tests and blood work, there are just things we don't know. We don't always know what's going on inside someone's body, and everybody literally is different and will react quite differently sometimes to the exact same thing. So that was a very important lesson for me, and that was unusual to have two such intense patients with these expectations that went awry. But the level of busyness in the book is very typical of a nurse on my floor. I've definitely had worse days than that day. Very occasionally I've had a day where I was significantly less busy, but the going in and out of doors and having your phone constantly ring and interrupt you and constantly recalibrating your to-do list, that is all in a day's work.
And in fact, you know, it brings up what is an issue that actually we've covered on HealthCetera over the years, and that has to do with staffing ratios and the number of patients that a nurse carries and how important it is to make sure that that number is not too high, and that we have the research that shows that if a nurse carries too many patients, the odds of that patient dying or getting serious complications increase dramatically. And I'm hearing across the country that these ratios are getting worse, that nurses are being assigned more and more patients. And I don't think people realize that nurses really are a surveillance system. So, it the idea of if you're not in the room and a patient starts to go down the tubes, as we say, that patient can go down the tubes. But if you're in the room, you can catch it early and get help, as well as the emotional component. And in your book, I mean, the emotional component is huge, and I want to get more into that in a little bit. But I think it points out the complexity and the demands on any a nurse at any one moment. You're having to choose between a patient who may be physically on the edge versus somebody who is emotionally on the edge. And that's so challenging to deal with.
That is very hard to deal with. And when I said I've had worse days than this day, I remember in particular a day where I had ended up with five patients because the nurse at the last minute couldn't come in. And we don't have any slack, so the solution was just divvy up the rest of the patients. And one of my patients, who we knew was dying, but died very quickly into the shift, and then another patient was, similar to Sheila, much, much sicker than anyone realized when the assignments were being made. Mm-hmm. So this poor family who had the death, I just couldn't really even give them my attention. The emotional needs that they had, I really didn't have time to address because the pressing physical needs of this very sick patient were so out of control. And it feels terrible to have to make that choice. It really does.
Yeah. Well, you write in the book about this emotional component, which I think is huge. You say it's the patients who get to be emotional and unpredictable, not the staff, or at least that's the ideal. I need to be in control at work. How difficult is it, Teresa Brown, to feel in control at work? And at what cost is that need to feel in control and be in control? Why do you have to be in control in the first place? Talk about that.
Yeah, well, you have to be in control because you always have more to do than really you can get done. Mm-hmm. And there are so many sad things that happen, and we don't build in buffers. So, for example, in the shift, a patient gets coded. So for listeners, someone, as you know, Diana said, is going down the tubes, and you call in what's called a rapid response team, and this patient ended up going to the intensive care unit. Someone we had all known for several years, was an incredibly sad moment, and there's no debrief, there's no let's all get together for 5 minutes in the break room and just hold hands. There's no opportunity to take those feelings and do something with them besides sit on them, because you have your to-do list and your patients who need you. So that is very, very challenging. And we know that there's a lot of burnout in nursing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of chronic health issues. I don't think the intense pressure on us to live with the stress and the physical difficulties and the inability to stay in the job, I think those things are related.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. You know, so it takes its toll on you personally to not be able to stop, essentially, and grieve. I want to share another quote, and this is about, you're writing about Mr. King, who, you know, you all had gotten to know and seemed to be responding well, but clearly is not responding now. And you say, "It's over for Mr. King, I think, and feel a lump forming in my throat. I shake my head, cough. It's not time to grieve. It's time to go home." How hard is it not to take that emotional impact of the work home?
It's very hard. The unfortunate thing is I feel like I've gotten very good at it, almost to an unhealthy degree, where I very rarely cry about things that happen at work, even though I feel quite sad about them. And I think there's a worry that if I open the floodgates, it won't stop, and there's just no time on the job to do that. So, unfortunately, you do bring it home with you. The really positive thing for me is what I have done with those feelings is ended up really appreciating my kids, my husband, my friends. They're really an antidote to all the stresses of nursing, and I just take so much joy in the fact that everyone I love is healthy. Mm. I can come home and we have an intact family. Mm-hmm. Because no one's gotten ill and not survived their illness. Mm-hmm. All those little things that people say are cliches, they have really become very, very important to me.
All right, so you got to be a truth teller, though, in all of this, because I think being a nurse every day does sort of harden you to some of the simpler illnesses, and I have heard complaints from others as well as from my own family that they get no sympathy from me when they're sick with the cold or the flu. Do you get that complaint?
I don't get that complaint, because the truth is I get a lot of colds and I hate having colds. So. My mom was visiting once, and she had just cut herself with a kitchen knife, you know, cooking like anyone's done a million times. And we got her Band-Aid and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, yeah, that, you know, it's good that wasn't worse, because I just really don't want to go to the emergency room on my day off. And
yes. Well, here's my story. I was sitting on a plane, a small plane, with a gentleman going home, and it was clear he was sick. And in fact, I think it was a flight to Pittsburgh. And I said, I hope you're, going to go home and be able to rest up and get some TLC from family. And he said, no, I won't. My wife's a nurse and she gives me no sympathy. So,
Yes.
So for people who have nurses in their families, I do think that sometimes the minor things don't always engender sympathy because of just the kinds of things that you've just described, as well as what's in the book. When you see the real drama of severe illness and of people dying, the other stuff sort of pales in comparison. And it's sort of like, yeah, okay, life goes on, you'll get over it, and here's some chicken soup, and drink plenty of fluids, and I'll see you later.
Right, because I have to go to work.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in keeping with this discussion, nurses, as well as other health professionals and ethicists, are writing about this idea of moral distress. And this goes back to the staffing piece, that when you are feeling like, so you had four patients, there are some hospitals in this country that the patients who you were caring for, the nurse would be caring for five or six, maybe even more. And at the end of the day, you feel like a patient died because I was not there, or I failed that patient because I couldn't be in the room when they needed it. And that over time, it's just this sense of distress that it becomes so difficult to live with, and that is associated with burnout. How much of that moral distress do you see among your coworkers, including physicians, including, the nurses' aides, social workers, etc.?
I see a lot of that in everyone, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we could be honest and say to each other, oh, I just feel like I'm stretched so thin, this really bad thing happened. It's almost like a conspiracy of silence. In a way, I think the really, really painful things about the job, only practitioners who are very close will share with each other, which probably also is not very healthy. Mm-hmm. But there's just a lot of it, a lot of a feeling of I'm overwhelmed, I couldn't do what I needed to do for that person. And again, there's no slack. So for a nurse or a physician or a physical therapist or whoever to be able to say, I just had to spend an extra half hour here. I mean, sometimes that may be okay, but other times you may really get smacked down for that. Like, well, you had this, and this to do, and you didn't get it done. And it's not a healthy environment, paradoxically, for maximally ensuring the health of patients.
So let me just pause for a moment and remind listeners that you're listening to HealthCetera, formerly Health Styles, that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. I'm Diana Mason, and I'm talking with author Teresa Brown, a registered nurse, who has written the book The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. And we're talking about the challenges of being a nurse and the need for people to understand what nursing work is really about, and that it is, in its fullness, a strongly emotionally challenging work. It's also physically challenging, and it's intellectually challenging. I think that people often really have no clue about the critical thinking that being a nurse requires. And Teresa, as an educator, I can tell you that people go into nursing and they think, okay, I can do this. And then they see what the challenges are just as students and how much they have to learn and the rigors of a nursing education. It's eye-opening. Was that your experience?
Well, I was surprised there was so much science, but I actually was very excited about that. So, you get a PhD at the University of Chicago, that means you're someone who likes to keep your nose to the grindstone. Yeah. So I was very glad that nursing meant having all these tough classes, and I really learned how bodies work. And so I enjoyed that. I think in general, the public does not understand how complicated and detailed our work is. And getting back to The View and their ignorant comments, the media really, really, really does not help this, because so many medical shows are only about doctors, and they only show doctors. Yes. So there are these hospitals like House completely staffed by doctors, yes, which is not how any real hospital in the world is staffed. And my request to these shows is, could you just show nurses doing the work that we do? Yes. Please don't show doctors doing nurses' work. Show yes. that work is done by nurses. So yes. starting IVs, calibrating drip rates, assessing for symptoms and reactions, all the things that we do that are extremely important, and we do them all day long in the hospital, yes. unlike the doctors who pop in and out, and then basically they're off the floor.
Yes.
You know, real doctors are not usually hanging around the hospital just waiting for a patient to need them. That's what nurses are for.
And in The Shift, in your book, you do describe different aspects of the care of patients that you have, the four patients you have that day, that I think does show the range of knowledge and information and critical thinking that the nurse must have. But for people who haven't read the book, and I hope people will get this book and read, it's a very good read, too. Could you just give people a flavor of that intellectual work, that critical thinking that goes into being a nurse on that shift?
Yeah, definitely. Probably the best way to encapsulate that is to talk about the drug that Mr. Hampton is getting, which is called Rituxan. It's a chemotherapy medication in a slightly different category than the others. And I'm only pointing that out to say that even that shows, my knowing that and being able to talk about it, shows a pretty sophisticated knowledge of different kinds of chemotherapy drugs. And we actually had a pretty intense set of classes to teach us about the different kinds of chemotherapy, how you give them, what the risks are, and then with our particular patient population, what do we need to look out for. So there was, you know, several weeks of full day class to just be an oncology nurse in my hospital, and that was done on the job.
And that was after nursing school?
No, not in nursing school.
Yeah.
Right. So all of that comes to bear with this patient. I get the written chemotherapy order from the MD, and then it's my job to double-check all the math on it, because most of these regimens have very specific requirements based on weight, and you need to double-check that the weight was figured correctly, you need to double-check the math, and then you need to double-check that the regimen that's chosen is the right one for this patient's particular disease. And then another nurse does the exact same thing, and only then does the order go back to the pharmacy after two nurses have signed off on it. And then the pharmacy does their own checking, and then they'll actually mix the drug. Then when the drug comes to me, there's a very specific regimen of taking vital signs and observing that goes with this particular medication, and all that I have to know how to do. And basically...
And how to interpret.
Yes, and how to interpret, right. Right. And to know mm-hmm. what's worrying, what's not. Mm-hmm. If there's something really, really worrying, what do we do?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, again, I think the public doesn't have a clue. And, in fact, when you're in the room and you're so-called chatting with a patient, you know, talking with a patient, et cetera, that you're also making a very thorough assessment of that patient by observation. You might even put your hand on their arm and feel that it feels clammy, and that means something to you, not just that the room's hot. And
no, that's in fact, this is fascinating, because Danielle O'Free, a physician yeah. who writes, was asking me about nurse-patient communication in contrast with physician-patient communication. And I said that we're trained that first conversation of the shift, you're getting a lot of information. You can find out things like, oh, you haven't been eating,
mm-hmm.
or you haven't gone to the bathroom mm-hmm. for 12 hours, or all kinds of stuff. But it looks like we're just in there chatting, being friendly.
Or you see that the patient's respirations seem higher than they should be and it wasn't reported on the shift, or their color looks poorly and there was no discussion about perfusion problems on the shift. So at the shift, change of shift. So I think, I actually talked with a producer of a television program once who said to me how why would I want to talk with a nurse? You know, I had this nurse who was being chatty, and I told her I didn't want to talk to her. I only want to talk to the physician. And I told her, how stupid of you. So, yeah. So,
good for you, Diana.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like what you don't know will hurt you. So, anyway, so it's another reason why I encourage people to pick up this book. It is The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours for Patients' Lives by Teresa Brown, and it's published by Algonquin at Chapel Hill. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program, HealthCetera, used to be Health Styles, that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, and we're going to continue with our conversation with the author of the book, Teresa Brown. Teresa, I wanted to pick up on some of the other, what you were starting to talk about the realities of healthcare and the pressures that all healthcare workers feel to do right now about the pressure to do more with less, essentially. There are incredible pressures on the healthcare system to cut costs, supposedly to improve outcomes, but too often I believe the focus is on the cutting of costs, and that can really jeopardize the lives of patients and the health of staff. You actually talk about, and I love this passage actually, you highlight the escorts or transporters of patients in hospitals and how the hospital blames them if they fall behind the schedule, despite the fact that the patient may just need more time getting ready to be transported. Talk a little bit about that person's role.
Yeah, those people are so important, and some of them actually have training, because if they're not just training to move patients, but training in patient care, because if there's a patient who needs to be transported who's on a heart monitor, they have to be taken by someone who's trained to understand what that heart monitor means, so that if they arrest or go into an arrhythmia, the person pushing the carrier will know what to do. And I really wish the public knew that, because this is not just someone you're paying $5 an hour to push around a stretcher.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who, they literally have your lives in their hands during that brief period when they're taking you from one place to another. But they really aren't given any respect. And in the book, I take myself to task a little bit for also not doing that, for taking them for granted. Mm-hmm. And it is very true that they can be on a very tight schedule, and you'll just come across a patient who says, I'm not going to go. I mean, I'm not going to go. I mean, I remember a patient who, it was fairly early in the morning. You know, of course, we expect patients to hop out of their rooms whenever we tell them, often at the drop of a hat, and some people are more resistant to that than others. But she said, oh, I haven't brushed my teeth. I haven't brushed my hair. I'm not going till I've done those things. And that was that. And then you'll get a transporter who will say, well, I can't stay then, because then I'll be late. And then the whole cycle has to start over again, and then that patient's scan is delayed, and then it delays finding out what's going on with them. So this focus on flow and, as you say, doing more with less, when you've got real people involved, it's that is not so easy. These are not books and boxes on an assembly line. Yeah, these are thinking human beings who sometimes don't feel good and sometimes just don't want to do what you want them to do right at that exact time. And, you know, I think that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. And picking up on that, but also your in the book you talk about the when attempts to heal actually harm, whether through over-treatment or errors or adverse reactions from treatments. And the errors piece really does, I think, arise from this sort of let's get them on the assembly line and people making errors because the system isn't safe. So you've left hospital care and now work in home hospice and palliative care. How much did the harm aspect of acute care play into your decision to leave hospital care? Certainly, it seems like that the distress of the long shifts and the distress every day of that emotional, although I'm not quite sure the emotional impact is any easier going to hospice and palliative care, but how much of the harm aspect of acute care played into your decision to leave hospital care?
Was an indirect factor. What motivated me more was after working in the hospital for several years and then writing this book about one day in the hospital, I came away with the feeling that hospitals could really do so much better for patients. And I thought that one way to get an idea of how that might be is to do home care because patients just seem in the hospital, they're not at their best. You know, they come in and we tell them, here's this horrible gown you're going to wear. Here's when you're going to eat. Here's when you're going to go to the bathroom. Here's when you're going to get up and go to a test. And in addition to all the other things that are happening, not letting them sleep, things being too loud. So what I've seen in the home is people have such a stronger sense of control over their environment, and it really helps them feel so much more peaceful. And I just want to keep learning more and more about that. But I also really like that in home care, you just have one patient at a time.
Well, your patient is the patient and the family, right? Sometimes you've got more than one.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
right.
Right. As you say, it's not that it's easier than hospital care. It's just that I'm never trying to have a hard, difficult conversation or put in a Foley or take down chemo with a phone ringing and someone saying, Teresa, where are you? And
Yes.
So that's a nice change.
So, Teresa, so you like this new work?
I do. I really do.
And you have no regrets about leaving acute care? Hospital care, let me say.
Oh, I wouldn't say the door is shut. Yeah, I just wanted to make a change. I mean, as someone who left teaching English in college to become a nurse, I never like to say that I foreclosed an option.
And I want to caution myself here not to say acute care because we know that care in the home is getting very acute. And in fact, the prediction is that hospitals of the future will be one big intensive care unit. Most of the other acute care that we now see in hospitals will actually take place in the home or something like what we call a nursing home today. But you're not only a good writer, and I think this goes hand in hand. You're an astute observer of people, of the world, and your own relationships with both of those. And I think to be a good writer, you have to be anyway. Your April Opinionator column titled Love, Death, and Spaghetti, which is a great title, describes an elderly Italian grandmother telling you to sit and eat before you see your husband who's dying. So you go on to write about the principle in hospice care of eating for comfort, or telling patients and family caregivers that the person who is dying should eat whatever they want and would enjoy and makes them feel good. But in this column, you also talk about feeding for comfort, feeding versus eating for comfort. Talk with us about feeding for comfort. I thought that was a very astute observation.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, this is an issue that comes up a lot for families, and I wanted to write about it because it really makes people suffer. Their loved one is getting very close to death and stops wanting to eat or drink. And family members think we are starving our loved one, and that really, really plagues them. And so they really want to feed that person. And also, food has such associations with love, with caregiving. It feels like a very elemental way to take care of someone. You know, as you said, you have a cold, here's your chicken soup. We associate food with caregiving, especially in situations where people are ill. So it's very hard for people to let that go. But unfortunately, if someone's dying and they're voluntarily stopping eating and drinking, not only do they not need food, but it may actually make them feel worse because all their body systems are slowing down and the food won't get digested very well. So it's really a balancing act. And the interesting thing was with this woman, once I started to talk to her about it, she really did seem to know that forcing food down her husband's throat was not a good idea, but it was so hard to let that habit go because that was how she loved him.
Yeah, yeah. And you did sit and eat with her.
I did. It became very clear to me that she was not going to talk to me until I sat and ate with her.
Yeah.
And the family, the whole family was there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she said, Teresa, you're going to sit, you're going to eat.
Yep, yep. Well, Teresa Brown, I want to thank you so much for coming back on to Health Styles to talk about your new book, The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives, published by Algonquin at Chapel Hill. Thank you for the writing that you do and for the stories that you tell that help to describe what nurses do. I think it's really important, and I thank you.
Oh, thank you, Diana.
So I hope that listeners will go get this book. It's available at most online, probably all of the online stores, as well as in some bookstores. So do look for The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of HealthCetera, formerly Health Styles, that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM New York.
And now, to close today's program, a reading from Bedpan Confessionals. In 2014, the Center for Health Media and Policy and the Hunter Bellevue School of Nursing sponsored Bedpan Confessionals, a live storytelling series by nurses about their experiences, the meaning of caregiving and illness, and the profound, sometimes humorous, moments shared with people when they are most vulnerable. On October 10th of 2015, the second Bedpan Confessionals took place at the Organic Soul Cafe of the 6th Street Community Center in the East Village. It showcased a diverse group of nurses telling their stories and reading their poetry about the work they do, and its impact on them and their patients. The evening evoked both laughter and tears. It challenged how people think about the work nurses do and gave us all pause about the experiences of health and illness. As we did with the 2014 readings, HealthCetera is broadcasting them as an ongoing series. Today, we're airing the first reading that will be introduced by Amanda Anderson. Amanda is a registered nurse in New York City and a graduate scholar at the Center for Health Media and Policy, who developed the idea for the readings, coordinated the work that led up to the evening's event, and served as the evening's host. She introduces Amy Berman, the first nurse to read her story at the 2015 Bedpan Confessionals.
So I recently had coffee with my roommate from nursing school, who is now a nurse practitioner in Washington State. Sue's kindly reminded me, in front of her new husband, that on our first day of clinicals, the first day we would actually be tasked with touching live patients, I almost passed out. Through our laughs, I recalled the memory. She was right. Within the first hour, actually, of my first day in the hospital, I had to back away from the first real patient in the first real hospital bed that I had ever seen. I'll never forget the darkness in the room or the hard wall that met my spine as I backed up quickly into it. Our instructor was showing us how to change a dressing with iodine-soaked packing strips. To this day, seeing that brown bottle in the supply room brings back those queasy feelings. I didn't pass out. But in that moment, against that wall, I realized that I had no idea what I had gotten myself into. No idea. What was this weird world where holes in bodies that weren't supposed to be there were normal, and it was my job to fill them up with medicated gauze while carrying on a perfectly normal conversation and maintaining consciousness? The literature department that I had left the semester before suddenly regained brilliant appeal. But somehow, I survived. I survived that first day of clinicals and the first day of my career in the medical ICU, and the first of many years of many other firsts. To this day, I've never passed out, or barfed, or even slumped against the wall again. But I have learned that none of those things are the things that really matter in nursing. What matters isn't me or my feelings. What matters is the person in the bed. Our first nurse writer, in her remarkable way, touches on this vital concept that all nurses must come to grasp. Amy Berman is a senior program officer at the John A. Hartford Foundation, an avid writer and tweener, and policy expert, a nurse and professional dragon slayer. For the second year in a row, Amy is here with us to share her tall tale of truth for you at the Bedpan Confessionals. Amy Berman.
You always remember your first love, first kiss, first heartbreak. We nurses remember our first patient. I was a fresh-faced nursing student sent to Bellevue Hospital. It was a forbidding Gothic relic of the building, and there I was in purple scrubs, the color of Barney the dinosaur, my hair in pigtails. It was just before 7 a.m., and I walked past the rusty iron gate and weaved through methadone addicts in the courtyard, waiting for the free clinic to open. I was scared to death. I hoped I wouldn't kill anyone. Thank goodness my best friend Erin was with me. Erin and I were overachievers who became friends and then study partners. We were a team conquering anatomy and physiology, pharmacology, pathophysiology, all theologies. Whatever the subject, Erin and I would study late into the night over really bad coffee in a local Greek diner. For the first 2 years of our nursing program, we never touched a patient. Book knowledge was our currency. Erin and I were A students, obnoxiously prepared, and hopelessly overconfident. But that gray Monday morning, walking into Bellevue Hospital, it hit me. I had no idea what to expect, and I was petrified. Our clinical instructor was a cheerful, roly-poly, middle-aged woman named Rose. She had been a med-surg nurse forever, or as they say in Brooklyn, forever. She started by orienting us to the floor. We keep linens in the closet. Here's where we keep medications, saline, IV equipment, syringes, here. Next, Rose handed each nursing student a checklist, a purple piece of paper with a laundry list of nursing tasks, like injections and sterile dressing changes. Each time we needed to do a nursing task with our patient, we were told to find Rose and get her to supervise us. If we were able to perform the task, well, then Rose would check off our little check sheet, competent. That checklist would stay with us until we completed the nursing program. Imagine everything you needed to know to be a nurse was on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of purple paper. Well, not quite everything. In the cramped room behind the nursing station, Rose gave us our first patient assignments. She handed each of us a chart. We eagerly poured through. Well, when we were ready, we went off to meet our patients. Erin's patient was just a few doors down from mine. She looked happy as she turned and disappeared down the hall. Here I go. I opened the door to my patient's room and immediately noticed that he was handcuffed to the hospital bed. Somehow, I had missed that detail in the chart. My patient was a prisoner from Rikers Island. A very somber-looking, armed guard stood at the end of his bed. All I could think of was that his gun looked very untherapeutic. It certainly didn't make me feel good. The first nursing task I learned was cuff care. That's the care you give to ensure circulation and avoid skin breakdown when someone is handcuffed to a bed. It wasn't on the purple checklist. I had just figured out there would be plenty more that wouldn't be on the purple checklist. Surprisingly, the rest of the morning with my prisoner, patient, seemed almost routine. He had tried to kill somebody at Rikers and then ended up with a puncture wound in his side from another prisoner's shiv. That's a homemade knife. But this was wound care, and I knew wound care. Aside from his leering, his foul mouth, the cuff care, the guard, and, oh, the gun, it all made sense. I did what I was taught to do for an open, draining wound. I felt pretty good. I wasn't going to kill anyone, at least not today. At lunchtime, all the nursing students were rounded up. Rose was still chipper. She led us into the cafeteria. Remember, don't discuss your patients. You don't use their names. Patient privacy. I wondered if I could whisper. Erin was not going to believe my morning. After going through the cafeteria line, we gathered at a table. Erin didn't look so good. She was pale. She looked sick. And she smelled strange. Not in a good way. Erin asked if we could talk privately. It was hard to find a place out of earshot, but we did. What's wrong? Are you sick? I asked. Erin started to tell me about her patient. She was in her late 50s, waifishly thin. She had breast cancer, a kind that Erin had never heard of, inflammatory breast cancer. It was a rare form of cancer. It had the worst prognosis, and it was spreading everywhere. They did a mastectomy after the breast had fulminated, or to put it plainly, after it opened up from the cancer. The woman's body was under siege. The chemotherapy kept her from holding down food. Her blood albumin level, the amount of protein in her blood, was so low that after they removed her breast, she couldn't heal. Her breast, or rather her wound, was a rotting, necrotic mess. And the smell, it was unbearable. Erin said she nearly threw up. A floor nurse had given Erin some Vicks VapoRub to dab under her nose. Wow, what an awful first patient, I thought. Just talking about it made Erin begin to perk up. Now I was curious. How bad could it be? I decided that I would stop by the room at the end of the shift to see for myself. Later, I said goodnight to my prisoner and hurried down toward Erin's room. It was just a few minutes before I was supposed to join my fellow nursing students in the cramped little room behind the nursing station. We were going to debrief. That smell, that thick, putrid, sweet smell, it made my nose hair curl. I bet you didn't know nose hair could curl. And the patient looked so small in the bed, a wisp of a woman. She smiled weakly. Then her expression soured. She looked down, embarrassed. I think she knew she smelled, Maybe my face gave it away. I smiled, but it was forced. I didn't want to add to her discomfort. Up until that moment, Erin's patient was an abstraction. She was nothing more to me than a set of challenges and nursing skills. But seeing her there, smelling her, sensing her embarrassment, I felt ashamed. It had escaped me that this woman, this patient, was suffering far more than Erin. We went back to Bellevue each week for the entire semester. Erin and I were her only visitors, the only ones to talk with her and reminisce. It never occurred to us that she wouldn't get better. She was in a hospital getting excellent care, and it was only a mastectomy. But 3 weeks into the term, Erin's patient died. We cried together when we heard the news. Thinking back, I know that this woman generously taught me what it really means to be a nurse, all the things that weren't on my purple checklist. She taught me about human dignity, dying, compassion, and the importance of human connection. She also taught me about my future, because I too have inflammatory breast cancer. Most people don't survive 5 years. But tonight, I ask you in celebrating with me, because it's been 5 great years since I've been diagnosed. And here's to the next 5.
Yes. That was the first reading from the October 10th Bedpan Confessionals held at the Organic Soul Cafe of the 6th Street Community Center in the East Village. And we're grateful to that community center for hosting the event. We'll be airing the other readings of stories and poetry in the coming weeks. I think you'll agree with me that nurses have powerful stories about the human condition that are the stuff of great drama and comedy. My thanks to Amanda Anderson for her leadership of Bedpan Confessionals. And my thanks to you for tuning in today to HealthCetera. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online on our blog at www.healthmediapolicy.com. That's healthmediapolicy.com. You've been listening to HealthCetera on WBAI 99.5 FM New York.